If you are unfamiliar with kind of the basic teachings of the Dhamma, or the teachings of the Buddha, just raise your hand. Of course, the teachings of the Buddha really are teachings of Dhamma, are the teachings of the natural laws, about the natural laws of the world and the universe. But more importantly, the natural laws concerning the body and mind in its interaction with the world around it. Especially in terms of what causes suffering, what is the cause of suffering, how does it continue, and also what are the causes for happiness. The Buddha wasn't interested in, you know, the exact time or place or who created this material world or whether there was a God or not a God, but he was interested in the mind and about suffering and how people, without understanding the mind, we've allowed ourselves to get all caught up in so many unskillful and unwholesome habits of body, speech, and mind that then produce their results as fear, worry, agitation, greed and hatred, and the whole gamut of mental problems and even physical problems. Because so many physical problems and diseases also have their root in the mind. But the topic of this evening's talk in particular is about the middle path. And the middle path is actually the first discourse of the Buddha after his enlightenment. He gave a talk about the middle path. And he said, these are concerning the material world, that the addiction or overindulgence in sensual pleasure is one extreme. That means people base their life on craving and desire, and they want to experience all the pleasures that can be brought by seeing and hearing, smelling, tasting, and touching, the addiction, the sensual pleasure, which leads them to do unskillful actions to get those pleasurable feelings. And on the other hand, the other extreme is denying oneself of any pleasure, or what is called self-mortification, sort of torturing the body and denying it any kind of pleasure, the basic needs of life, like starving it or inflicting unnecessary pain on the body by, neglecting it. So the Buddha took the position of the middle path to avoid those two extremes, because each of those extremes unbalances our mind and doesn't allow the mind to have clarity and doesn't allow the mind to become peaceful and centered. So, and then he defined the middle path as the Noble Eightfold Path, such as beginning with the right view or right understanding. And right view means this understanding the nature of the mind and how the mind is intimately connected with the objects of the world, but understanding especially like the law of karma and how every action has a sort of an equal and opposite reaction. Or the law of gravity, if you throw something up, it comes back down. So whatever we throw out of our body or our mouth or our mind, even our thoughts, goes out in the world, intermingles, and it comes back in one way or another to cause us some sort of problems, or suffering, pain. If we act with an impure mind, out of ignorance. But if you act with a pure mind, if you act out of wisdom, and with the more kind of pure thoughts, non-greed, non-hatred, then happiness and comfort come back to one. So the middle path in the, you know, is, you know, based on that right understanding. And then he goes on to say it's the right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. All of these also are following the middle path. They avoid the extremes of too much talking or no talking, too much action or no action, too much effort or no effort, too much thinking or no thinking. So all those aspects of the Eightfold Path, called the Middle Path, they're avoiding all those different extremes, the extremes of thought, the extremes of speech, the extremes of our action, the way we live, the extremes of our effort. So many people kind of go back and forth between those extremes. They exert a lot of effort for a while, and then they burn out, and then they, you know, lay back and do nothing for some time. And they're caught up in various extremes that keep the mind in a kind of unbalanced state. In the modern interpretation of the middle path, or what a lot of people say, it's moderation in whatever one does. But especially in those ways that we use our body and mind. So we can use the things of the world that we need for our basic kind of ability to live in a comfortable way, but not to abuse sensual pleasures, like abuse of, you know, the body, or abuse of food, or get addicted to any type of things, addiction to any types of things that unbalance the mind. But at the same point, not to deny ourselves nothing either. And whatever we use or do, we do it in that, with the right understanding of what is enough and what is too much, based on how it affects one's body and mind. Now, there's some other aspects of the middle path also, which are kind of more philosophical. And it deals with the concepts of is the world real or not real? Is the world eternal or not eternal? And, you know, these are certain views of the philosophers. So this is the materialistic viewpoint. Is the viewpoint that this material world is real and absolute. And it'll exist forever. It's often called the eternalist view. And the opposite view is a nihilistic view, or the view that nothing exists. That all exists or nothing exists. Is the world real or unreal? But the Buddha also followed the middle path in those terms, between those two extremes. And he wanted us to understand, you know, it's not does the world exist or does the world not exist? Is it eternal or not eternal? But how does it exist? You know, how does this world exist? And he explained that in his teachings of dependent origination. I'm not going to go into that, it's a very complicated thing, but basically it means depending on ignorance, the body and mind and has arisen and consciousness keeps on going from moment to moment, and we go on creating karma, and we keep on, propelling or generating the process of our life. But especially in terms of creating kamma. But that can also subside when we understand that we shouldn't deny the world, but we shouldn't cling to the world tightly either, knowing how the world basically is created with it, from the mind. And one of the most important, profound discourses of the Buddha, he said that the world, the arising of the world, the ceasing of the world, and the path leading to the ceasing of the world is right within this 5 or 6 foot long body with its nervous system, memory, and consciousness. And so basically it means that our concept of the world, our experience of the world, is created within our mind. It's not that this physical world doesn't exist, but the way we relate to it and the way we see it is created within the mind. And we can either use this mind in a skillful way, or we can use it in a way that brings us suffering. And unfortunately for, you know, many people in the world and then other innocent people, you know, they have to suffer because of the ignorance of, you know, a few persons and using the mind to create all kinds of suffering. Or other people use it to create all kinds of goodness. So anyway, this idea of is to understand how our mind creates the world. And so you can see how the mind and the world exists, but when you go into meditation, when you've trained yourself in meditation, if you want to, you know, through meditation, you can sort of stop the world creating process. That means if you develop your mindfulness and concentration to a high level, you can go into a state where, you know, even the feeling of the body sort of dissolves and everything else going around you is seen as is experienced as basically just kind of empty. And you can experience an incredible amount of bliss and happiness, which is coming from the deepest levels of wisdom of the unconscious mind. And so you can temporarily suspend your thinking process, and with it all the worries, fears, anxieties that you might normally be, have from time to time. So that's what's called stopping the world. That means the feeling of you being a separate existence. Most people have this idea that, you know, they're a separate person inside their idea of I or self. You know, you appear to be separate from the world out there. But actually, that's just a thought within the mind, a thought that's being continually recreated in the mind. And it's really the source of most of our anxiety and fear, because everything we experience is reflected back to me. How is that affecting me? And I, me, and mine. And then having fear, greed, or fear, anxiety, and worry about not getting what you want, getting what you don't want, and the fear of the future or the past. But all that is created within the mind. And you can see how it affects a lot of people. As people, you know, suffer from so many mental problems or diseases, but it's all mental because they're trapped within the mind. And so the Buddha, through the practice of meditation, his practices of meditation, especially the practice of mindfulness, is designed to develop the right understanding of what the mind is and learn how to untrap, free the mind from its being caught in that trap of delusion. So the middle path is part of that process about understanding how the mind has come to be and how it's created all of its complicated thoughts and feelings and emotions, but at the same time understanding that they're not absolutely real and we can untrap them. We can untrap the mind and we can dissolve those negative thoughts, feelings, and emotions also to experience a greater freedom. So, another one of the middle path is the self real or is the self not real? The idea that, some religions or philosophies have the idea that there's some permanent soul or I that's within you that'll live for eternity, whatever your belief is. After death, one's soul or consciousness will go somewhere and stay for eternity with one's individual identity. So that's one extreme or one view. But the other view is that this ego or self is simply created within the mind and it's not something that's eternal or real. And you can actually dissolve it. Or transcend it, transcend the trap to it, to attain complete freedom. So, and that also you can experience in meditation. Because as long as the mind is paying attention and identifying things and reacting to things, the feeling of self appears to be very real. And even the more anger and greed one has, that's the way the mind keeps itself, the ego, strong. Because, when you have a lot of greed and desire or you have anger and hatred, the ego is really, alive. You feel very alive. But when you go into deep meditation and your thoughts subside, you can directly see how that sense of self also starts getting less and less and weaker and weaker. And as it does get weaker, you experience a great relief and a kind of a liberation from that. So anyway, that's just another, kind of a direct way that you can see how this sense of the middle path between clinging to the self with an ignorant attachment and using this self to dominate others, or using the sense of self and ego in a very practical way, knowing we have to live in the world but not being deluded by it, by seeing how it arises and it also passes away. And then there's other aspects of the middle path, which is the past and the future. So people get caught in the past and future. Some people are more caught up in the past. Older people are more caught up in the past because they don't have much future. The younger people are caught up more in the future because they don't have that much past. And they think they're going to live another 50, 60, 70 years, so they're planning out their whole future. And that also brings worry, anxiety, and fear. All problems are problems of the past and future. Try to think of any problem that you have, and you see somehow it's identified to something in the past or the future. And that could be even the future of just a second from now. So in the practice of meditation, the middle path is the present moment, trying to rest the mind, to be grounded and rest the mind in the present moment. That's the middle path, not grasping at the past, not grasping at the future, and also not grasping at the present moment, but allowing the mind to float from moment to moment. Just like a sort of a beach ball floating in the surf out here, you know. They just go, you know, up and down with the waves, and they just float, you know, with the waves of, you know, that are rolling in and out. And, you know, they don't get sunk down underneath. So in that way, in the training of mindfulness, we train the mind to be able to float from moment to moment, riding the wave of impermanence, but without getting stuck in the past, not getting stuck on the future, not getting stuck on pleasure, not getting stuck on pain. And that way, the mind, you know, experiences a more freedom. And to understand that really the past and future are creations also of your mind. And all there is the present moment. You might have an idea of the future, but it's an idea in your mind. And when the future comes, that will also be the present moment. And each time you think or worry about the future, that's occurring in the present moment of your mind. But when the present, when the future comes, it's nothing but the present moment. And the same with the past. You're brooding over the past, but you know, you're recreating it in the mind. Although we can learn from the past and future, it's not that you totally let go of that, but don't get trapped by it. See, it's the middle path. It's not that we're rejecting one or rejecting the other. It's not getting trapped and caught in either extreme that then causes us problems. Knowing that the true nature of the mind is the middle path. And so another aspect of the middle path is the extremes of, again, of pleasure and pain. So like in meditation, you feel some painful feelings, and so you're struggling and trying to get away from, you know, various aches and pains. Or when you feel some pleasant sensation, like when you get a few moments of some mental quiet, and you feel some lightness and you feel that pleasant feeling, then you can see the mind wanting to hold on to that. And then when it starts to go away, you get disappointed. Because all those things are impermanent and we can't control them. So that's why also in mindfulness training, we train ourselves to keep the mind in the middle. Again, the middle path is nothing but mindfulness. It's the mind that's in the middle. And so we're not reaching out and trying to hold on to the pleasure. We're not trying to push away pain. But we're keeping the mind in the middle, knowing that even pleasure and pain are created within the mind largely. Pleasure and pain are simply sensations. But the way our mind reacts to them, the way you've been trained, or have trained yourself, it emphasizes that. Because the self, the concept of I, is always wanting pleasure. It's always trying to go toward pleasure. But for most people, they've been disconnected from the inherent and intrinsic happiness that's already within themselves. And so they base their happiness on the external world. So they go around trying to create pleasure and happiness by indulging in all kinds of things. And then creating negative karma by stealing, lying, cheating, killing, raping, plundering, in order to get those sensual pleasures or to get away from the painful pleasures. Anything that threatens your greed or attachment, then you know. But knowing that those are really just created within the mind. So that's why in Vipassana meditation and mindfulness practice, it's important to learn how to observe those and realize, you know, what the middle path is, especially with the pain. You see pains arising, but mostly, usually people just react quickly. They don't want to observe that pain. They just want to get rid of it quickly. So they'll, you know, itch this and rub this, and, you know, constantly moving. But actually, if you learn to just observe those sensations, you realize, they're not that bad. They're doable, you know, for 10 seconds, 30 seconds, a couple minutes. By learning just to observe and relax, you can see how actually it's the mind's attention and worry about that that's actually making it worse. And if you don't pay so much attention to it and just feel something else, the mind will forget about it. Or it will just kind of be there in the background, but will no longer cause you any, like, you know, a strong disturbance. So this is the way that we learn about our mind and about how easily our mind has been, you know, uncontrolled and is just running us around, doing things that we don't really want to do, but simply because of habit. And then another aspect of the middle path, probably one of the most important ones in terms of actual meditation practice, is between the subject and the object, or the knower and the known. So the knower is our sense of ourself. And the known is the object that we're hearing, seeing, feeling, smelling, tasting, or even thinking about. You have the idea that I'm thinking about this and I'm thinking about that object of the past or future. So it's called the knower and the known. Those are the two extremes. We get attached to the known and we get attached to the knower. But what's in the middle? In the middle is knowing. Knowing is awareness that's resting in the middle. It's not clinging to the object or the known, and it's also not clinging to the object of me, the knower. But most people don't know anything about awareness or knowing, because in our fast reactions and fast thinking, we jump from the knower directly to the known and don't realize the knowing. We don't see the knowing that's in the middle. It's like, you know, you're meditating and then all of a sudden, you know, for people that are, you know, kind of new to meditation, they get an itch, and immediately in a split second, they just jump right to the object. There's no space in between. Or you feel a pain, or you hear a sound, you know, there's no space. So they don't know anything about awareness or knowing. But when you slow down, and you train yourself to, you know, endure whatever sensations and just to observe, and you're sort of watching that painful feeling, or you're just sort of noting, you know, itching, 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 and you're kind of just watching the itch, then you will be able to discover or observe that, you know, in the middle there is this, the knowing or the awareness. It's like a buffer zone between the known and the knower. And when you let go of the known, in Vipassana meditation and our training of mindfulness, we train ourselves to kind of let go of the known. What does that mean? That means you stop chasing after sounds, feelings, even your thoughts. You just stop with, you know, hearing, hearing, feeling, feeling, thinking, thinking. You don't identify with the content of that or the objects of that. And so you're, you know, kind of letting go of that chasing the known or reacting to it. But then the knower still exists. So you could be sitting in meditation and most of your thoughts subside. You're no longer reacting to things. You know, even pains are there, but the mind is, you know, stays centered in a very peaceful. And so it's like the external world is almost ceased. But there's still the thought of I'm a good meditator. I'm close to samadhi now. You know, and all these thoughts. So the knower is still there. But then through practice, eventually that sense of the knower will also dissolve, and one can then experience true or pure knowing, which is again, you know, the middle path, and avoiding those extremes. Because if you cling to the known, then you drag in the past and future about it, worry, anxiety, and fear. And also, if you cling to the self, then you're also drag in worry, anxiety, and fear. Connected with yourself. So this comes through the right understanding again. All these aspects of the middle path, whether it's avoiding the extremes and the actual dealing with the world from moment to moment, or if it's the extremes of your own mind, your viewpoints, and the extremes of pleasure and pain, the past and the future, is understanding how all these things are basically created within the mind. In the mind, by the mind, and for the mind. Simply by not understanding what the mind is, we've allowed ourselves to get, you know, through the course of growing up. When you're a young baby in the womb, 9 months you're in the womb, but you didn't have any thought of me, self, or I. It was just a kind of a, you know, an oceanic kind of awareness that was plugged into the body, you know, via the umbilical cord, you know, plugged into that life force coming through the umbilical cord, or plugged into the developing nervous system that's tied into every cell and tissue of the body. As it's evolving and millions of cells are being produced, you know, every day, and the fetus is growing. It's a tremendous energy. It's like a nuclear bomb. But the consciousness is tied into that. But then when you get pushed out of the womb and the umbilical cord is cut, then you've lost touch with that oneness. You've lost touch with that source of life. Now you're set to drift in the world. Your parents give you a little name, little Johnny, little Susie. Whenever they start calling your name, you start looking. They give you things and you start, you know, eating. And so that process begins then. And then it continues the whole life. And because of society and of ignorance, it's continually being reinforced. You know, the sense of the ego and the desire and for things, simply because of ignorance. And even the greatest scientists who, you know, blasted rocket ships to the moon and invented all kind of, you know, all the wonderful things of medicine and technology, even they don't understand the mind. Not in the sense of, with the depth, let's say, of somebody like the Buddha, in terms of understanding how the mind really creates the world. They pay lip service to it, but they don't, you know, we might have read these things in some science books, but mostly it's just lip service. And they haven't, no one's taught us the way to actually control our mind and to control consciousness and understand it in the way of keeping it liberated and free from the traps that, you know, we've allowed to, you know, grow, evolve through the life. And now people, you know, and they're 20, 30, 40, 50 years old, you know, they're trapped, you know, in all these, in these extremes of the world and the extremes of their own thoughts. And most people don't ever get out of it. But that's why the Buddhist teaching of the middle path is such a complete kind of teaching, because it deals with the material world, and it also deals with the mental world in ways of, again, of avoiding those extremes. It's based on the wisdom that knows that everything is ultimately empty of any absolute concrete identity. Even the ideas of good and bad, black and white, you know, all the polarities and all the dualities are simply created within the mind. And if you understand the mind and you understand how that works, you can have the best of both worlds. So a meditator, a mindfulness meditator, or a person who develops wisdom, they get the best of both worlds. You can enjoy the material world and the mental world, but not get trapped into it. You know its limits, and you know the purpose of it, and you don't get trapped into it. And at the same time, you don't get trapped into the other extremes of trying to annihilate the world. But you use it not to cause it, to create suffering for yourself. You use the good aspects, or you treat the world as real when you need to, and when you don't need to, you see the world as empty. So when there's something to be done that's necessary, like acting out of compassion, love, kindness, helping others, just satisfying the basic kind of needs, we act as if the world were real. But when we start acting out of greed, hatred, and delusion, and other negative thoughts that bring pain, like, you know, negative actions, then we apply our emptiness to it. And we withdraw the mind from going in that negative way. See, that's the wonder of meditation, and the wonder of mindfulness, even the miracle of mindfulness. When you need to act and do something, then the world is real, you do it. But when there's no need, you rest in emptiness. You come back to your source. And you rest in the present moment. And not going into, and when you see the negative tendencies arising, again, you withdraw the mind back from that way. So You know, these are all just, you know, again, different aspects of the middle path. And again, it comes back to all these things are accomplished and achieved by following the Eightfold Path of the Buddha talk. That means starting with right understanding. Right understanding has three levels. First is intellectual understanding. The second is understanding gotten through reflecting and observing how things are working in life around you as well as in your own mind. And then the third level of wisdom are the deep intuitive insights, the deep insights that we get in those deepest levels of meditation. And because our life, the whole world, the way the world is, comes from our viewpoints. The way that you believe, or your world of view, the way that you believe is the way you're going to think. And the way you think is the way you're going to speak. And the way you speak is the way you're going to act. The way you act is the way you're going to live in the world. And your various actions. So that's why, right understanding is important. Because if your understanding or viewpoints are crooked, then all of your thoughts, and speech, and actions are going to be crooked. I mean, just to use that word, or unskillful. And we can see that the way the world has come to be, the situation of the world today. If you have a belief that this earth was created especially for the human beings to dominate and rule, and the animals were put on this world, earth, for us to eat and to populate the world and to enjoy, and then we've raped and pillaged and polluted the world because of that, overpopulated it, until now it's becoming more difficult to live. That's come from a viewpoint. So, and that's, this is just an interesting little comparison. That's why the viewpoints of the Eastern countries, like India, that's 4,000 years old civilization, 10 times older than, let's say, the U.S. in terms of its modern, history. But yet, India never developed. Because their viewpoints were more organic and simple. And they didn't, it wasn't that the people were stupid or didn't have resources. They have just as much as here, but the viewpoint wasn't that. It was more organic, and they see themselves as just part of nature, more or less. Not as somebody, some superior being to dominate others. So anyway, that's just a kind of an example, just to emphasize the importance of the right view and the right understanding. Okay, well, I think that may be enough for this Dhamma talk, and I'd like to open it up to any questions. If anybody has any questions about any of those things I mentioned, feel free to ask some questions. Can you speak a little louder, please? Well, I can't hear you better.